we have one case on our 10:30 docket, Henderson versus Henderson.
May it please the court, Mr. Leighton Durham will argue for appellant, Mr. Thomas Michelle will argue for appellee.
All right, Mr. Durham.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Leighton Durham on behalf of Jacqueline Henderson. This is a fairly straight-up appeal with a single issue, which is whether a clarification order entered by the trial court altered a substantive property division in a divorce decree, and specifically whether certain voting agreements that Jacqueline was ordered to sign gave her ex-husband Daniel greater rights than were awarded in Section 1.2 of the agreement incident to divorce. The applicable law here is really not disputed. What we're disputing is the interpretation and how it should be interpreted. We agree that interpretation is based on contract principles, and that the primary concern is that the true intentions of the party as expressed in the agreement be enforced. In this case, we have three arguments as to why the agreements vested in Daniel rights that were not awarded in the AID and therefore altered the substantive property distribution. The first is with respect to the nature of the rights awarded, and in paragraphs 2 and paragraphs 5.1 of the agreements she was ordered to sign involve irrevocable assignments and transferees being bound by the agreements. That's one area. The second area is a right of first refusal and in the nature in which it was done. That's in paragraph 5.4. And in paragraph 6.2 deals with the release of fiduciary duty. Each one of these provisions appears in the 9 agreements she was ordered to sign. And those agreements are in the record at the first volume of the clerk's record, page 38 through 105. Turning to the first point, which is the nature of the voting rights. Under the voting agreement that she was ordered to sign, Jacqueline was ordered to vest in Daniel irrevocable, transferable voting rights that bind successors. Unfortunately, none of these provisions actually appear in the agreement incident of divorce, and the fundamental flaw here is that Daniel, in writing these agreements, has assumed that he was vested with ownership in the voting rights. What he was given was the right to exercise those voting rights, and the ownership remained with her. That's clear in Section 1.2. Moreover, the right to exercise was given to Daniel alone. It was not given to Daniel or his assigns. It was specifically given to him alone. And in construing these restrictions on voting rights, the court is required to do so very narrowly under the Tenneco case cited in our brief. So to narrowly construe the award to allow him to transfer to assignees, that's not a narrow construction. That's a broad construction. It adds terms. What was given to him was the right to exercise, not the right to transfer that right. There's also no provision in the agreement incident to divorce that says that the assignment continues after the shares are sold. Truth is, there's no provision either way. What we have is in Section 1.2 a very specific stated purpose for the provision, which is that the whole reason that Daniel maintains the right to vote is so that he can control these shares and that Jacqueline would be precluded from management within the company.
And I assume these are closely held corporations and that that's probably clear in the record somewhere.
These are closely held family organizations owned 100% by the husband and wife at the time of divorce. 50% was assigned to her, 50% was assigned to him. And that's part of our argument. The whole point is that if he actually owns the voting rights, she didn't get the 50% that she was awarded very clearly in the record. And so when that purpose, when if she sells those shares, the entire purpose of awarding him those the right to vote expires. It no longer exists. And to effectuate the intent of the party, she needs to be able to sell those shares with the right to vote so that she actually does have
according to your position, his voting rights are protected because he has the right of first refusal anyway.
That's correct.
So if he doesn't want her to sell it to Joe Blow down the street, he needs to buy the shares.
He can just buy the shares, right. And then he's fully protected, which is very common in these divorce situations and closely held companies.
Are there any restrictions on the stock certificates themselves?
I don't think you can see the
agreement or anything like that.
They're not on the stock certificates themselves, although I'm not confident those are in the record.
Okay.
What is in the record are the agreements. So that's the first issue. The second issue is the right of first refusal. And under the voting agreements, again, it's a transferable right, although the agreement ends in a divorce, doesn't create a transferable right. But more importantly, it allows Daniel to exercise them in a piecemeal fashion. And to understand why this is incorrect, you have to understand that a right of first refusal is a term of art. Under the law, right of first refusal is matures into an option to purchase upon an offer to a third party on the same terms that were offered to that third party. Acceptance has to be unequivocal and unconditional, and a purported acceptance on different terms is not acceptance but rejection. So when Daniel was awarded a right of first refusal, he was awarded a certain right recognized in law, which required him to exercise the entire offer and not piecemeal. Daniel, though, in the agreements, modified that. He did so by allowing himself to exercise only a portion of the offer to a third party, in essence, modify the number of shares in the offer. That gives him a discretion to do alter the terms and gives him greater rights than what were afforded in the AID.
And when you refer to the agreement, you're talking about husband's proposed voting agreement.
I should be more clear. It's the voting agreement. I apologize. Because we have the agreement incident to divorce and then the proposed voting agreements. And I say agreements because she was ordered to sign those and
right.
has been
okay.
compelled to do so. But the voting agreements contain this right of first refusal that gives him the discretion to exercise it in a piecemeal fashion, which is inconsistent with what a right of first refusal is. In his brief, Daniel has argued that the issue is moot because there was a courthouse offer to settle, that they would remove that provision from the agreement, but that's really not, doesn't moot it. The brief was the first time I had heard about this offer to settle, but the point is, in the record, there is no such offer to remove that, and Jacqueline is still under a court order to sign and abide by those agreements, and therefore they aren't moot. The third and final point where the agreements went too far is on this breach of fiduciary duty. We're not arguing at this point that the agreement incident to divorce establishes a fiduciary duty. What we're saying is that it does not preclude a fiduciary duty. Both sides recognize that there is certainly that potential, and this court has recognized as well that even in informal relationships, when somebody is acting on behalf of another, there's a real potential for a fiduciary duty. And Daniel's recognized that by requesting that we waive any claim to fiduciary duty. The agreements, though, in the subject, they grant an immunity that was not granted in the AID. So Jacqueline was ordered to abandon any claim that a fiduciary duty exists, and Daniel was given that valuable right and a release that any fiduciary duty exists. So what you have are three instances where the agreements, the voting agreements, exceeded what was awarded in the AID, therefore substantially changed the property division, and therefore are void under the Family Code, Section 907A and B. And for those reasons, we'd ask that the court reverse and remand for further proceedings. If you have any further questions, I'd be happy to address them.
What is the, you said she's been ordered by the trial court to sign?
Yes.
So what's happened with that?
In the record, there's a status report that reflects that the agreements were signed.
Okay.
And Mr. Michelle might be able to answer that question better than me, but that's what the record reflects.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Durham. Mr. Michelle.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, the answer to the court's yes, she did. She signed them at the time that she was ordered by the court after the clarification order, and then so she did execute those. Your Honor, to address one of the situations you, one of the questions you raised was, would Dan Henderson be protected by having a right to first refusal so that he could, quote, I guess, reacquire those shares of stock, things? He would not be protected. It's a right of first refusal. These shares of stocks would cost a substantial amount of money so that he would have to be forced to outlay and come out in cash and to purchase those shares of stock should he so desire. It's a different thing. That's why he wanted the voting rights so he could control these companies. These are companies he did. This is what he did. It was his livelihood. He wanted to have it. There are other shareholders. That's why we have the next paragraph in here saying that she is restricted to sell them only to other existing shareholders in the company. So
but where does it say that in the AID?
Paragraph 1.2. third paragraph. So specifically, voting rights versus purchase of shares of stock are two vastly different things. And that's what we negotiated for in this contract. And the things that were negotiated that weren't put in there, for example, under paragraph 1.2, he, Daniel Henderson, was awarded the right to exercise the voting rights relating, and this is a quote, relating to the shares or stock, I'm sorry, shares of stock or units awarded to her, meaning Jacqueline, herein. So the voting rights went with the shares of stock, and specifically in paragraph 4.8, once again, a negotiated term between the parties. This agreement binds all successors and assigns, so it's specifically contemplated that if there were any assigns, that it would specifically bind those subsequent purchasers. Further, as the court is probably aware, that contracts are fully assignable at law unless specifically prohibited. Here we address that issue and specifically authorized the assignment be binding. On page 2 of their reply brief, they specifically state, Jacqueline says that, quote, section 1.2 of the AID, the agreement incident to divorce, requires Jacqueline to assign her voting rights to Daniel. That's their language and their interpretation, that 1.2 requires her to assign her voting rights to Daniel. This was a belt and suspenders provision relating to voting. Voting is quite different than management. Obviously, as the court can probably tell from a review of the final decree of divorce, we had an agreed temporary injunction against Jacqueline Henderson, who was trying to destroy the very assets that she's now complaining about. That's why there was an agreed judgment injunction, permanent injunction against her from doing anything to destroy the value of these companies. You can also glean somewhat, although it wasn't an issue at the trial, she got a vastly disproportionate award of the estate, 70 to 30 at least, from what we could tell. This was an issue. I will say Jacqueline's representation about dividing shares of stock in this case is correct. What these assets are these companies are basically they have patents. And so then they have to sue on those patents. And so they're, by their nature, very cash or
liquid.
Liquid, yes, exactly. Good point. All those things, hard to value, hard to liquidate, things like that. They could have a value in the future. And, in fact, since this time, a large part of this has probably become somewhat moot because these companies have proceeded on down the road. She's been distributed a lot of her money through her ownerships. So the ownership, that's what we crafted in this deal, was the ownership interest, quite frankly, was the huge value in these types of lawsuits. That's what she got. That's what she protected. And, in fact, she has gotten hundreds of thousands, if not over $1 million, of money distributed through her ownership of the shares of stock. We divided that. One thing is Dan Henderson, that's what he does. He is the client. He is the person who goes and testifies about the patents. Because it's a funny world of litigation, these patent cases, because it's the piece of paper, you know? And they search and they acquire these pieces of paper that are the patents. And they sue AT&T and T-Mobile or anybody else for infringing upon some texting message thing that was invented 15 years ago. That's what these lawsuits are about. That's what they do. He is the person who has the knowledge and experience. He's the one who had control. Also, Justice Livingston, these other paragraphs don't provide the type of protection about the voting rights because she's required, these are closely held companies that are, and they're required to be sold to other shareholders because of the inherent nature and confidentiality of these assets. In fact, both sides agreed, hey, we're not going to value these assets, even if we attempt to value them, because then they become discoverable in the lawsuits, and then they get used against them. And then would devalue both sides' values on future lawsuits.
Okay, so is it the fact that they're closely held corporations, the shares are restricted to sale to other shareholders for any of the shareholders?
Yes, absolutely. That was inherent within the small world of the shareholders. That's correct.
Okay, so really then you didn't need a restriction within the confines of the agreement incident to divorce to further limit it. In other words, she could only sell to other shareholders.
Right, the actual shares of stock, correct. That's consistent with the underlying documents of the corporations themselves.
So, but how could she ever sell it to another shareholder, or why would another shareholder ever buy it if they were never going to have voting rights?
You know, I take that back. Dan, break that down a little bit, because I apologize. Dan Henderson did sell some of his shares. The thing Dan wanted to do was make sure he could control the company in case she sold her shares of stock to other shareholders, and that would push her, because they had the same amount of shares and ownership. If she joined up with one of the other shareholders, they could wrestle control of the companies away from him. By keeping the voting shares, he could retain, although recognizing the division of a divorce, that you've got to split the equity aspect of it, which is natural. So she got the economic benefit. He, as the head of these companies and the man on the hot seat, and he gets sued quite often by any of the big companies. You know, it's a very, very amazing area of, I've learned a little bit about it, but federal court litigation, things of that nature, very hotly contested. He was the person, but he wanted to be able to be the one to control the direction of the companies, because he is the one who lived it, breathed it. So there were other shareholders, and he did sell some, and there were other shareholders in these companies. So one thing, the object of what we tried to craft was for her to get the economic benefit, because we couldn't liquidate the assets unless and until they prevailed either in settlements or in, a jury verdict, things of that nature. A lot of the times these things do settle, and that has happened in this case, and substantial amounts of money have been distributed to both parties. So in that respect, he needed to maintain control of the ability to navigate these pieces of paper litigation, because he's the person who testified and directed and negotiated and worked with corporate counsel, worked with IT people who investigated the patents to see the flaws and the benefits and all those things. If Jacqueline sided with another shareholder and sold her shares with those voting rights, Dan's, because they had to split the shares, his voting rights got diluted. Okay, and so that was what we were trying to do. She had no notice of all. She hasn't lost value of these things. He had control of the voting rights. The asset, in reality, it's all somewhat kind of academic and fictional, because at the end of the day, they're going to take these lawsuits. They send them out to these, what I call, very high-powered national litigation firms that end up prosecuting these cases in federal court, and then Dan manages it and directs, trying to help work with counsel. But a lot of times, you know, he's very one of these lawyers had George Bush's lawyer who handled him on the presidential case against Vice President Al Gore. Amazing stuff. But a lot of that's what they work in tandem. Jacqueline, at the time of the divorce, was, you know, upset and was doing disparaging things to the companies and was going to say all types of bad things about the companies to other people. That's why we got that permanent injunction. They're saying, hey, whoa, you're destroying the very assets we're trying to get. And on top of it, Dan needed to have the voting rights so that if she did decide to sell them, and which is fine, she's welcome to do that, that he didn't lose control of the country, because their once combined ownership would have been split in 50-50, and he would have been diluted under the 50% and could lose control of the voting of the companies. So that's what we try to accomplish here.
Do we get to look at the permanent injunction or any of the testimony behind that in making this decision?
I would think you would probably look at the permanent injunction, because it is in the final decree of divorce. And so the final decree of divorce actually is the document that incorporates the agreement incident to divorce. So those are all there. They're all part of the record. Yes, I would say, aside from that, I think the document speaks to itself, because they themselves say in their own brief that she had to assign her rights under that. Here we talk about She's not voting the rights. He's getting the right to vote the rights relating to the shares of stock, and then we address the assignability of it as well, so that should there be any assignment and things like that. As far as the other items about selling under to other shareholders, that really doesn't protect him as far as voting. In fact, that can hurt him. He would then, because they would combine the shares of the of Jacqueline's shares with their own shares and then could take control of the company, which was something they were very worried about. So that's why we put those voting rights with Dan. And for a long time, they made a great living with Dan doing these. They're really tied together. They have the same equity position in the shares of stock. Because of these unique natures of these lawsuits, it's no difference. I mean, they go and they settle a claim against AT&T for $500,000. It kind of goes down what we call the waterfall. Lawyers get their contingency fee off the top typically, and then it falls down to expenses that are outlaid. Then it goes to the equity holders. And then Dan and Jacqueline are on the exact same line. They both have the same disbursements and distributions. So they're very they're tied very, very much together on the success of these companies, and that's what they really want. And I don't think he's going to say up or anything. Obviously, I've lived this. I've gotten to be kind of educated on this. But they live and die together on these things, on whether these cases do well. They took a huge hit on a great patent in Chicago.
But none of this really matters. Don't we just look at the intent of the parties when they entered into that agreement incident to divorce?
I think the doc in our question, one, I think the document clearly specifies that, because I think paragraph 1.2 does that, and we buckle it with the final decree of divorce that's in record, which is part of this, as well as the assignment. I think all of those things go together to read the plain meaning of the document. Now, I guess the court could do, which I argued with the court a case a couple months ago, which the court could find sua sponte that it's ambiguous. Ambiguous. If the court were not able to discern the intent of the parties from the face of the documents, the record. But obviously, we've argued before to in our responses to this that the document itself clearly articulates those things. We think 1.2 does not protect him, provide him for losing voting shares rights, because it allows her to sell her ownership shares with that. With regard to the piecemeal, we think it's okay. We had tendered revised ones that would allow it not to be exercised piecemeal. Fiduciary duty, I think they agree it certainly doesn't impose a fiduciary duty. If the court were to say it doesn't not impose a fiduciary duty, I think, you know, that's okay. I think the intent of this situation is, because for the most part, they're tied together on the benefits of this. So I don't think in the end it's going to matter too much on those. But we certainly would like to retain those voting rights, which we think we contracted for. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Michelle. Mr. Durham, rebuttal.
Just very briefly, whether Jacqueline attempted to destroy the estate, I don't know. It's not in the record as far as I can tell. Whether she got a disproportionate award, whether she's received receipts from these companies or in these lawsuits, whether Dan's intent was, based on the parole evidence that was just offered that wasn't in the record, none of that really matters to the sole issue. We've got one issue, and whether that is whether the agreements incident to divorce or the voting agreements granted rights that exceeded the agreement incident to divorce. And we've got three reasons why it does that: the nature, the fiduciary duty, and the right of first refusal, any one of which requires a reversal, because the trial court's order would therefore be void and require reversal. We've been through why Mr. Henderson was granted substantial protections in this, including the right of first refusal, but it really all boils down to what is the intent, and that intent is squarely addressed in Section 1.2 in the next-to-last paragraph, such that this really isn't a very hard issue. If you have any further questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Thank you so much.
I guess not. We appreciate your arguments today, and we appreciate your briefing. You all are excused, and your case is submitted. We will now adjourn court.
Thank you.